Question I can answer. The question is, why didn't Bhishma Dev say anything when Draupadi was treated in a disrespectful way in the assembly?
Is that yours?
Yes.
There are different levels on which this can be answered. One is on a level of line of authority, that Bhishma Dev couldn't speak out in a certain way that he wanted to speak because he was under the jurisdiction of the king, and everyone continuously looked to the king, which was Dhritarashtra. What was he going to say? Because his opinion was final. So people were waiting for him to say something. And every time they waited for him to say something, he said nothing. Another level that I've heard answer to this is that Bhishma Dev, he was showing the example of what it's like when you're in the company of people who are not pious. And because of their lack of piety, their company affects you. And Srila Prabhupada spoke about this, that because he was taking the food given by the Kurus, he was influenced by that association. So he told us we should be very careful whose food we eat, because we'll take some of their karma. And another reason was, it's a very difficult one to us to understand, was that Bhishma Dev was a bhakta, but he was a jnana bhakta. So he knew who Krishna was. And he didn't speak because he wanted to see Krishna act. But this one is very difficult for us to understand because we don't ourselves have the subtle level of bhakti that Bhishma Dev did. There's many more things can be said, but we have to keep moving.
Ultimately, Krishna wanted the battle to take place. Krishna wanted the battle of Kurukshetra to take place. He brought all the kings to remove the overburden of the world. He brought them all into one place and then had them all removed at once. So Krishna's plan was the ultimate cause of that. But there are so many other causes as well, and other things to be learned as well. Okay, would you like to? Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Is that your question?
Yeah.
Got it.
Okay.
Poor handwriting.
This one's not a question, it's a book. Must be yours, yes?
Yeah.
One of yours. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6,
one's
7.
One's okay, one question's fine.
Okay. Why did Sri Chaitanya forbid his devotees from associating intimately with the Brijbasis? What happens if a person does associate intimately? Well, first of all, it's better to keep the questions on the particular topic we were speaking about.
But we were told you could have any topic.
Okay.
Not any topic.
Not about your son's grades in school.
Okay, but this is not about your son's grades in school. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, don't associate with them, and because they're on a different level. They have a different level of understanding. And there are many ways to understand that point too. And he told not his devotees, he told one devotee that. He said to Jagannanda, when you're going there, you should associate with Srila Sanatana Goswami. Don't associate with the local people. They're on a different level. Because their mood wasn't the mood that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was teaching. Mahaprabhu was teaching the mood of separation and the mood of dealing with, especially with Radha Krishna. But their mood was different. It's more like Krishna as a son. So if you mix different moods, you'll become mixed up. Mixing mixes you up. So that's the simplest way to understand that. And what happens if you do associate with the Brijbasis. If you try to keep your mood and they have a different mood, so of course some simple association, you didn't mean that, but if you try to deeply understand their mood and enter into that mood, it may pull you from the mood of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, because they're not by nature, not by birth, they don't follow Mahaprabhu, they have a different relationship with Mahaprabhu. For instance, Mahaprabhu, he respected Govardhan Hill as different from Krishna, as the same as Krishna, so he wouldn't walk on Govardhan Hill. But the Brijbasis are very respectful to Giriraj, but they have a different mood in relationship to him, and they walk over Giriraj. So you can easily get confused, which path should I follow? So if you try to follow two paths at the same time, or three paths at the same time, or four paths at the same time, you get very, very confused. If you try to dig a well here, and then dig a well here, and dig a well here, and then dig a well here, you never get deep in any of your wells. So it's better to dive deeply into the mercy of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Well, that's what he told Jagannanda Pandit.
Thank you.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
How do you practically move forward in spiritual life when you still have attachment for objects and pastimes, etc., that are unrelated to Krishna's service?
The question we all face. Yes?
Yeah, that's a very real question that comes to, I think, everyone's mind at some point or another. What do I do with the fact that I have other things going on as well? And we're hearing all the time of this high, pure, ultimate perfection, and I don't sometimes feel like I'm anywhere near that, nor am I even feeling like I'm going in that direction. I may find myself diverted. Well, this is a question of a practitioner. Somebody who wants to make spiritual progress, but how best to arrange their practical practice so that they can do that when they're not yet out of the beginning stages of Krishna consciousness, wherein we're still very much enamored with this material world, basically. One thing, there's many things can be said, and so I want to only say one thing now so we can keep our answers short. But one thing that often helps me is that when I become, for example, very much attracted to something of this world, I try to tell myself, so that I'm not going in two directions all the time, I try to tell myself, you know, that which is attracting you in the material world, that's also Krishna. The material energy, that's also Krishna. He made that. And he exists within that. So if I'm thinking that this is so attractive, imagine how attractive he is. And in this way, it tends to allow me to shift, instead of fighting with a difference of direction, it tends to help me to shift them so they can gradually become one direction. But also we're recommended that our Krishna consciousness, on one level, we're encouraged to be very serious and take everything seriously right now. But on another level, beyond that, we're encouraged that we should use our whole life and move forward gradually. Keep moving forward. So if I suddenly find myself attracted to something else, see if you can turn around like that and keep moving forward. And gradually you'll see that you will make significant progress. And at a certain point, the percentage of what you're attracted to about Krishna, the scale, now it weighs the other way. That there's more and more and more about Krishna that's attractive to me, and less and less and less deviation from that. So this is should be the result of continuous practice.
Same handwriting. I'll save this one for later.
I can answer them all together later.
Currently, our hearts are impure. and we have many anartas. So how can we develop faith that Krishna will protect us from everything? Is it not that we must purify ourselves first and then get faith on Krishna's protection? So as I understand this question, is it will our I'll take it in a particular way, that if we get purified, which is, I'll take it in a way that automatically says what an answer is, that if we get purified, then our faith will increase. So it's not that faith, if we wait till we're pure before we have faith, if we're thinking in that way, it's never going to happen, because no one ever feels I'm completely pure. Even the greatest devotees feel themselves as very impure. So it's a continuous process of purification. And the essence of the process of purification and the essence of the process of gaining faith are actually the same. The essence of the process of purification and the essence of the process of gaining faith are the same. And that is to associate with devotees. If we associate with devotees and hear Shastra, for example, in their presence and chant Hare Krishna with the devotees, then our faith increases and also we become purified. What does purified mean? Purified means our material desires get less and our spiritual desires increase.
Question. What is fear? Is it the feeling of not fully knowing the unknown? For example, we are all afraid of death. Is it because it is a part of the unknown? Please explain. What is fear?
So there's two parts, yes?
Yeah. What is fear, and is fear something to do with not fully knowing the unknown? Fear. What do you? Well, how would you define fear?
Well, there's a verse in the Bhagavatam in the 11th canto, 2nd chapter, that directly answers this question. Bhayam dvitiya binaveshatasya shad apitasya parito smriti. Fear means that when you see something is separate from Krishna, living in a world of duality, that this is Krishna and this is something separate from Krishna, and that separate from Krishna is unknown. So that brings the part about death. But Krishna even says in the Bhagavad Gita, Mrityu Savas Harascham, that I am even death. So nothing is actually separate from Krishna. No person, no place, no circumstance. So to see duality, this is Krishna and this is something else, is the definition of illusion. And that immediately causes fear. And the rest of the verse speaks about the cure for this. It means that basically you have to accept the spiritual master and you have to follow the instructions and you have to practice Krishna consciousness. And then what we want to feel is, as we were hearing, that we want to have the experience, not just feel it as an emotion or a sentiment, but to actually have the experience that my life is meant for Krishna's service and Krishna is always with me and protecting me. So therefore, as Prabhupada said, this isn't danger, this is Krishna coming to me in this form. Maharaj Prickett, Narada Muni. When Narada Muni died, he had developed a spiritual body in such a degree that instantaneously, as soon as his gross body died, we could say, he immediately, instantaneously, at the same moment, like lightning and illumination occur simultaneously, he was living in his spiritual life, his spiritual body. He had developed that in his life. So this is ideal. And this is the perfect state. So we should try to see mercy in all circumstances and see nothing as separate from Krishna. Did you want to add to that?
I was thinking about a feeling of not fully knowing the unknown. So in one sense, we can never fully know the unknown. Right? There's always a new uncertainty and we're so small. So fear also has to do with when you yourself are responsible for what's going to happen. There's only you facing this. There's some very difficult situation, and I'm the one who's about to face this, and I'm going to face it alone. So as I was telling devotees recently, it has given me a lot of comfort in my spiritual life to think of this analogy that Srila Prabhupada gives of the Katha Upanishad gives of the two birds in the tree. I heard when I was doing something, I was listening to Srila Prabhupada, and all of a sudden he said, in every body, there are two souls. And it just shocked me. Like, two souls? You mean there's somebody in with me? You know? I mean, I sort of switch identities? And then he explained that there is this, and I'd never heard it put like that, that there are two souls. So we have an accompanying master, friend, and protector. So when I can't realize that, I can't even understand that at this particular point, but the concept is so reassuring that I have within me somebody to talk to, somebody to share my difficulty to, somebody to ask, should I turn left or right? And the difficulty is, as we were saying, I'm interested in the other things, and so I haven't yet been able to draw my attention to contemplating this. But this is very extraordinary. I have a guide, I have a protector, and I have a very dear friend. And as Bhanuswami was saying during his class at the temple, he explained that when somebody starts to try to come towards Krishna, then Krishna himself enters into the role that the impartial Paramatma plays for every other body. And he himself is willing to direct us from within. And then, so that we can know as much as possible and confirm that we're listening not to our temporary fickle mind, but we're getting some intuitive guidance from Krishna, we have those without who we must learn to trust and follow. And between the two, if they both tally, then we start to become confident that actually I'm becoming purified enough to now be trusting myself to possibly be listening more to Krishna. And that means I'm coming to the point that I want to serve more. Not that I want him to fix my problems. Oh good, I've got a plumber inside, an electrician inside. I know I've got a guide and a master, and this removes fear.
Is there a story behind all the daughters who were born of Mother Sachi, as there is a story behind all the son Kalani who were born to Devaki regarding Kalanemi? I don't know this, if there is a story behind them. I don't know what it is, because they all died before Mahaprabhu was born, to Mother Sachi, but those daughters, I don't know the story. Do you know that story?
No, I've never actually heard anyone speak of that. But it's interesting that it was six sons and six daughters, and then the Lord appeared. And also before him, Vishwarupa appeared. And then
yeah, so perhaps someone could look in the Chaitanya Bhagavat and see if Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur comments on this. Where is... Do you have the Chaitanya Bhagavat?
Yeah. There are actually eight daughters of
Okay.
What are the essential personal qualities when searching for a spiritual partner for consisting spiritual, progressively growing family? What are the essential personal qualities that one should look for in a partner for having a spiritually progressive family? Well, one should look for qualities that are simple. Like, one should see whether the person is developing an interest in spiritual life. Very simple. You should see if they have an interest like that. Because if they don't have an interest like that, if they're firmly interested in, they're not interested in that at all, then one should go very cautiously forward. One should see if the person is a good person. Sometimes, I remember one time, one devotee told me that their spiritual master, they were a young woman devotee, she was from Germany, and she went to her spiritual master and she said, you know, I want to marry somebody, a good devotee, this. And her spiritual master told her very gently, he said, I suppose that you should look in the world outside and you should find somebody very nice who you can make into a devotee. Because he knew her nature, he knew her disposition. And factually speaking, that was what happened. She met somebody, he had good qualities. She had good qualities. And gradually, by her faith and conviction, she was able to turn that person towards becoming an initiated devotee. So without going into more detail, I think those are a couple of important points.
I'm glad you got that one.
What does that mean? We'll talk about that later.
I've heard and also seen other people's experience that if you share your spiritual realizations, especially your quality of chanting, the next day the quality of chanting drops. Some people say, Nazo lagi hai. Did I get it right? You should never share or tell your spiritual advancement with others. What is the verdict of Gaudiya Vaishnava Siddhanta? So there are two direct quotations about this. One by Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, and the other is by Srila Narottama Das Thakur. So don't casually, the point is don't casually, not that you should never tell anyone about your spiritual advancement, because you want to check to see if you can improve. So you should not, it's not that you should never talk about it, but it is just talking about it loosely, here and there. That's what Narottama Das Thakur says. But Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, in one of his books, he explains that love of Krishna, or prema, it's like a lamp that's kept in a secret box. And if you let it out to everyone, you will lose it. So that's actually true. So, and it also, in Vrindavan, they also say if you tell people how many rounds you chant, you're immediately giving away 50%. Which is so I remember one time we had a japa retreat, and one devotee was just chanting, and there were different classes and everything, and he was like chanting the whole time, and chanting the whole time, and chanting. And at the end, when we were sharing realizations, he said, he announced to everyone that he had chanted like 160 rounds in one day. And I said, thank you very much for your charity. Because the false ego can so easily enter into this, just numbers, and look at my chanting, and look at my realizations, and things like that. So it will work exactly the opposite of what you want, and you will lose it. But rather, these kind of things are just shared in very, very intimate moments with devotees who are very, very intimate with, and not at all casual, because they are a gift. They are never something of pride, because one shouldn't be proud of gifts that one gets, causelessly one gets. Is that all right?
One time I was in Vrindavan, and I was sitting in a shop that with a shopkeeper who was very nice. He was a Vaishnava, and we were doing some transaction, but as we were sitting there talking, and he looked out, and you know, the shops don't have a front, and one lady went by. She was a middle-aged lady, and she had three or four younger ladies with her, and they all had traditional saris on, heads covered, and they were just going by. And he said, you see that lady? And so I stopped and I looked at the lady, and he said, you know that lady? She has done more charity in Vrindavan. She has given more than anyone else in Vrindavan. But everything she does is anonymous. And I was really taken by that. And I remember a few times after that, I saw that lady and she was on her way to Banki Bihari Temple. And then I would see her going back and with her family members. And there was such a modesty about this woman, but she was so wealthy. So it really struck me, the two things together, that when we do something and say, look what I just did, it's a little childish because we don't have much and we did this with it, we're very excited about it. But this lady had so much that she didn't mention it to anyone. She didn't want them to know that.
And about charity, there's said that charity, I can't remember it all, but charity, when the Bhagavad Gita talks about this too. When you give charity or donations and you want to get some fame back or something back from it, that's in one mode. I've made so much, I'm giving something for God or to others. And then another level of charity is I've worked so hard and gotten this money, so I'm going to give everything. But another level of charity is in a completely different mood, is that Krishna has put this money in my hand, it's his money, and he's put it in my hand for me to use in his service. So let me use it in his service wisely. A different levels of charity in that way. But not directly talking about what you asked.
Why does Kunti seek children from devatas if one should only seek help from Krishna? So this is a good question. The first thing that comes to my mind in answering that question is that Kunti didn't seek protection from the devatas. There was a practical request by her husband that somehow or another we have no children. And she remembered this mantra and she told her husband, and it was on his request that she took the mantra and she arranged the progeny. So she herself was not taking shelter of the devatas, but she was serving using that particular facility. So her mentality wasn't that if she had been taking shelter of them, then each devata she would have developed, then she would have been a little unchaste because she would have a relationship with all these devatas. But in fact, she had no relationship with them. She had a relationship with her husband and then ultimately with Krishna in that regard.
Okay, this last two questions and then we'll move on. Why should we pray to Krishna asking for assistance in our lives when he already knows what is going to happen? What is the importance of prayer? So this is a... Did you ask this question, Raj?
No.
Oh, okay. Good point. So this is a many-faceted question. So one part of the question is, why should we pray to Krishna when he already knows what is going to happen? So this is a very deep philosophical question. Krishna knows what's going to happen because he knows what you're going to choose. Not because he knows what's going to happen and you choose what he already knows. So this is a very interesting philosophical question that's argued about by people of all religions. If God knows everything, do you have free will? So one way of understanding the answer to this question is he knows what you're going to choose, but by his knowing, he's not making you choose another what you're already going to choose by your free will. So why should we pray to Krishna when he already knows what is going to happen? So the devotee, what Prabhupada explained in one purport that I mentioned right in the beginning, they don't even ask Krishna, please protect me from this and protect me from that and protect me from that. The deep devotees, they feel themselves so carefully protected for Krishna, by Krishna. They're only thinking, Krishna, please allow me to serve you. And that mood of please allow me to serve you and dedicated to Krishna makes Krishna in the mood of please let me be. I will protect my devotee like that. So the deepest devotees don't ask Krishna for anything, knowing that he already knows what they need. But because we may not be on that level, We're encouraged, the kama sava kama va moksha kama udaradi. Whatever our needs are, whatever our desires are, whatever our fears are, we should turn to Krishna and no one else. And gradually we'll come to the level of complete dependence on Krishna. And whatever you want, Krishna. Because that's what I want. Whatever you want, Krishna, I know that's best. You're the doctor. You give the medicine, not me. When I pray to Krishna that you should do this, Krishna, you should do this, Krishna, you should do this, that's presuming that I know what is best for me. Perfectly. I know the future. I want that Krishna give me this new car, but then I get the new car and big problem can come. So was that actually best for me? So the devotees, they're surrendered to Krishna. And they see him as the great doctor who's prescribing exactly what they need. And Krishna has come to me in this form of danger or in this form of whatever it is. It's Krishna. So what is the importance of prayer? The importance of prayer is a way to express the heart to Krishna and especially to glorify him. And how do we learn the best way to pray? We read the prayers and enter into the mood of those who are very, very, very deep devotees. The prayers of Kunti Devi, the prayers of the Brijbasis, the prayers of Marachitra Ketu, the prayers of Prahlad Maharaj, the prayers of Narottama Das Thakur, Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And then we, by entering into their mood of prayers, our method, our praying improves.
Ramayana and Mahabharata are meant to teach duty. Vedic standard provides safety and proper behavior. How we as devotees can learn and know what is proper behavior while living in the middle of the general society? What standards can we apply considering our time, place, and circumstance? Well, the way I think about it is that you take those ideal behaviors and you see how much you're capable of applying them realistically, and you don't reject them and you don't try to follow them in a rigid way that's really not possible and practical for you. But you take your standards from some ideal standards to begin with. Otherwise, it's very difficult because then you have to make them up. So Bhagavad Gita gives us some guidelines. In Mahabharata gives us some guidelines. Ramayana gives us some guidelines. And we can extract from them and try to find out what is the principle here and try to do the best we can. It's a simple thing and it's a very complicated thing at the same time. It's simple because here it is. Now you try and do it. And it's complicated because the general society, as we say, is very different. And we have not been brought up in that culture. And in fact, when Srila Prabhupada was pointing out to me, in my own case, the example of the Indian family we were staying with, because he was trying to strengthen my sense of being a wife and being peaceful and satisfied to be a wife. And so he talked about the Indian characteristics. He wasn't even talking very strongly about high Vedic characteristics. But he made the point that this lady, she's happy just to be with her husband. She's not dissatisfied. She's not restless. And she has even an altar in her wardrobe because they were only just becoming devotees. And she's like this and she's like that. And he was pointing out three or four or five things that were very characteristic of somebody who was born in Indian culture. And they were so totally different to who I was and my age and stage of life. And I was listening to Srila Prabhupada and I thought, I better say something. Because if I don't, it means I accept what he's saying. And in fact, I wasn't accepting what he was saying. And so finally, I got up my courage and I said, but Srila Prabhupada, I wasn't born in this culture. And he stopped and he looked at me very concerned, very kindly. He looked at me for a moment with all his own culture. And he said, yes, he said, that is true. But if something is good, why not try for it? And I thought to myself at that moment, what a reasonable answer. If he had said anything else, if he had said, yes, I know, but you must do this, I probably would have totally rebelled. But I could hear from him, yes, these different qualities and behaviors are superior to my own. How will I ever follow them? I don't know how I can follow them, but why not try? So that gave me a lot of confidence over many, many years to keep trying and keep trying and to continue to use this life in an endeavor to try for something that is not natural. It's not culturally supported around me, and it's not automatic. But the effort of continuing to try, if you have a desire for something that is better, anyone can do.
Thank you very much for your very thoughtful and honest questions. So many of them.
Later.
Now we're going to move on to the...
Yeah, the rest can be answered by email.
Yes, and here they are, Saka.
You said the magic word. After. The rest can be answered.
Yes, we're going to move on to the next part. Now, let's see, I think some of it rests on me over here. What we're going to do is break up into small groups of three or four in a group. And there are three things we want you to discuss, and you'll have 10, 15 minutes to discuss these. But it's not gone. Just three simple questions we want you to discuss. During these 2 days, what did you hear that was most meaningful for you? What struck you most deeply during this weekend of Krishna Katha? Not necessarily what you heard, but just anything that might have struck you. And third, what thoughts, moods, practices, or philosophical points would you like to take with you when you leave? So just go into groups of three, four, five. Why don't we put, would you like to be with the, this is one group right over here. Okay. Just whoever is around you. Don't pick and choose. Just whoever's around you. Just discuss. So 10, 15 minutes. Another 5 minutes only. And please concentrate on the last one. Right now, for the last 5 minutes. What would you like to take with you? And don't say the tent. Or the millipede. You can take all the millipedes. Now, if everyone takes 5 millipedes.
What if you don't go anywhere?
I'll take ants.